in those early days, I just think I was so keen to like push what I thought was my voice, which was like incredibly sassy and glib and aloof, and I just felt like that was who I was going to be as a writer. And I think with confidence and time has come just like, oh, just say it like it happened, and people respond to it better. I enjoy writing it more. It just creates a different kind of proximity.
Hello, this is In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell, and that voice you just heard was Raven Smith, columnist for American Vogue and author of two books of personal essays, Raven Smith's Trivial Pursuits, which came out in 2020, and Raven Smith's Men, which was published in April last year. Londoners will also know Raven as a bit of a stylish and popular man about town. He's the kind of person who everybody wants at their parties. And some listeners may be aware that he's a big deal on social media. He's widely considered to be one of the funniest people you can follow, and his one-liner picture captions are tiny works of comedic art. I think that makes him possibly the only guest I've had where a discussion of writing for Instagram is part of the interview. I recorded this episode earlier this month at Raven's office in central London. It's a very old, kind of historic building, as he'll explain, in a busy part of town. And at times you'll hear water running in the background and cabs honking their horns, which I hope all adds to the atmosphere. Raven actually studied photography and worked for the online video channel Nowness for several years on visual content, so it wasn't until he left Nowness that he started to write, as he will explain. I found it really interesting to hear him reflect on how he evolved as a writer. I think every professional writer learns and develops on the job, but I love how honest he is about that process. I think he'll probably always be a writer who's attracted to humour and very good at being funny, but he's quite consciously shifted into writing more thoughtful essays and columns that aren't quite so packed with jokes, particularly in his second book, Men. He's also great on life in a TV writer's room, how he approaches his Vogue column, and what he learned from newspaper editors. Before we start, I'm delighted to say that this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. Since they launched in 2011, over 180 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including critically acclaimed authors like Bonnie Garmus, Jane Harper, and Kirsty Capes. Curtis Brown Creative ran a wide range of courses covering a variety of topics and genres. If you're interested in bringing your true stories to the page, you might want to join their 6-week online Writing a Memoir course with teaching videos, resources and writing tasks from best-selling non-fiction author Kathy Rensenbrink. Curtis Brown Creative have given me an exclusive discount to share with you. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of Writing a Memoir or any other 4 or 6 week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I'll be back after this interview with a few things to tell you, but for now, over to Raven, who started by describing his writing space. At the beginning of this episode, we have a bit of light-hearted talk about some of the more adult stuff that goes on in the corner of Soho where his office is. So if there are sensitive ears in the room, then you might prefer to skip the first minute.
We are in Soho, London. I was going to say swinging Soho like it's the 60s. We're in Soho, London. I have a small white box for writing above the Windmill Theatre. They've just put a license in to do actual sex there, so I'm quite excited to be above a sex shop, some kind of performative sex place. It's
wow.
Great.
It is a really old school Soho corner of Soho, because I think a lot of Soho isn't really like that anymore.
I think we're very lucky. The landlord was this guy who made porn in Soho, owned a lot of it. There's pictures of him in the on the desk in the next room, in the room next door to this, with like 60s girls in bikinis and fur coats. And his daughters now own a lot of the buildings, and they are very keen for Soho not to become just kind of like Starbucks and McDonald's, and to have people here making stuff that isn't kind of
doing
big business.
Sex performances. Yeah. So would you just sort of visually describe what we can see around us?
Yeah, I mean, I can only apologise because I find starkness helps me concentrate. So we have four white walls, two desks at the moment, Out the window, you can see the top of a hotel. They have a beekeeper that comes every week to do the honey for the bee, for the beehive.
That's so cool.
And then kind of six sets of bedrooms where I've never seen anyone having sex. And I'm really disappointed by that after all this. I've been here like 2.5 years.
It's a nice view as well, because it's a sort of contrast of the new buildings and then opposite this kind of, I mean, I have no idea about architecture, but what looks like a very old slated roof, and some sort of cracked paint windows, and it's very atmospheric, I think.
Yeah, it feels like the kind of place that when they like have lunch on the roof in Notting Hill, like very bohemian and cool.
And so yeah, as you said, very stark office, nothing on the walls, very functional. So what do you use this room for?
So I write a weekly Vogue column, so I'm always here on a Wednesday writing my Vogue column. And I actually have found, despite having a couple of tables in my house at home in Camberwell, that coming to a space to write, when it's time that I want to go home, the words start to just pour out.
Right. It sort of puts you on a bit of a deadline kind of thing.
It's just before the bell at school and you're like, I better get this finished because then it's home time. So I find no matter how much I procrastinate, I always finish the work so I can go home.
That's really good. How long have you had this for, this place?
About 2.5 years, and I've been, before that was on Old Compton Street, so
okay,
even more Soho and even more gay.
Okay. And so what are you working on writing wise at the moment?
I've just filed my latest column. I wrote about Harry Styles and
it was very good.
Thank you. Intersectional privilege. I don't know if I coined the term. I like to think I have. And then I'm tentatively thinking about book three and whether to pitch it, how to pitch it, what shape it could and should take. And I'm also, just in the last month, I've joined a writer's room for a TV show. My first ever writer's room.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
So obviously that's not here because it's somewhere else doing writing in a room. But so how's that going for you and what's the experience like? Oh, is it? So you are here?
It's an American/British. The show spans both of those and there's writers from both places in the room. So we do a Zoom with all of us on little screens like the Brady Bunch. I mean, you know Zoom. No one needs me to explain Zoom.
How does that work? What's the sort of structure of those Zoom meetings? Who's talking, and or is everyone talking over each other? Or how do you?
You basically there's a lot of like, oh no, sorry, you go first. But it's my first ever writer's room, and I thought writer's rooms were like white cis men stand-ups just like barking over each other and like one-upping each other. But it seems much, for me, it runs much more like kinder and smoother and politer and a bit less competitively. And then we have a script on one side. We have the outline. We're doing it's 10 episodes. We have an outline and then we just say yes and to everything. That's it. It's such a great gig.
It sounds great. How did that come about?
The showrunner just was like, would you like to come and work on the show? We had a chat for about 45 minutes about the difference between English people and American people and the cultures colliding. I lived in New York for 90 days when I left university, so I kind of have that a little bit of insight into going that way as well. But the show's set here and I just said yes, a month of it.
That is so great. So you're doing that every day at the moment?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Every afternoon into early evening. It's a funny like time, 1 till 7, because it's not the morning. And when you finish, the day feels like it's over. I'm like, what am I doing at 7? I don't know.
I think what I would do is probably just completely waste the morning if I was starting work at 1. But I mean, here you are doing a podcast recording. So.
Yeah, I've been trying. I think I've settled into it. It's week three and I've settled into it a bit more and felt a bit less like I'm a real early bird. But like getting up at 8 and not starting work till 1 wasn't quite working out for me.
Right.
So I've just been doing a lot of pottering.
Pottering, yeah. So what is your sort of routine as a writer? Like if you're in, you know, what time of day do you like to get in here? You said you're an early bird. And how many sort of hours of concentration do you think you have in you?
Good question. The autonomy in me is that I'm a really early bird, but I can't actually write early. There's two types of writing for me. One is to like hold on to an essay, and that is a column or a commission, and I can sit here and think about one thing and write about it quite happily and hit my deadline, hit my word count, feel like I'm doing that nice little tap dance around something. I always think sometimes it's a room song and sometimes it's a corridor song. So like, do you know about this in musicals?
No, tell me.
You have three types of song. You have the I want song at the beginning, which is when your protagonist says, I want... The name on everybody's lips is going to be Roxy, and that's what she wants from the musical. And then you have a room song, you have a corridor song which gets you from one place to another, and then you have a room song which is just a feeling, and you just do riff on a feeling.
Okay, and so what's your column? It's a room song.
Ooh, it's both. Ooh, but I quite like. Yeah, I think my first book is a lot of room songs, so I can just doing a little tap dance about. Being tall or getting lots of emails. And I think my second book has more corridor men in it, Raven Smith's men, because the idea is that they are taking, each man has brought me closer to my understanding of masculinity, of my own and of others, and internal and external.
I like that. Okay, so maybe men, your book Men has more of a sort of narrative in a way, because it's moving you through something.
Yeah, I think I approach them both differently. So to write books, so I love being here. I do a lot of nice tap dances about subjects for people while I'm here. And what I find with book writing is the actually holding on to the conglomerate of essays is really difficult to balance alongside anything else. So I usually just leave the country, live alone, nomadically in Berlin, in my friend's house in Berlin, but just type, and it lives. I find that books for me just live right behind me. They're a real spectre for me until they're out, and it's very difficult for me to, if you ask me about it, I'm insufferable, so I just try and keep that to myself.
Why insufferable?
I remember calling my husband and saying, oh, I'm not sure about the order of these chapters. And he's like, why don't you sleep on it? And I was like, I've slept on this for 3 nights. It's just like...
So tell me to sleep on it.
And the answer's always within. So I can't...
Yeah.
It's almost like... It's a bit like a lot of my friends have kids, and which is fantastic. And we go out for a few drinks, and then you ask one question about their kid, and then they can't stop. And that's what I'm like with a book.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, and this, and I've been thinking this, and that, and this. And it's so abstract until it's on the page in your hand.
I think that's why, you know, there's an audience for podcasts like this. And I think it's why, if you're a writer, it's really good to have other writer friends, because nobody... Very few people who don't write are as interested as you are in talking about it, understandably.
Yeah.
And I think you do actually need sometimes, whether it's listening to somebody talk about it on a podcast or whether it's calling a friend who's been through the same thing and talking through it, I think you do need sometimes to get it out of your head and circulate it a bit, you know?
A friend of mine, Eva Wiseman, she was just like, I don't know why people... whinge so much about writing, just write it. And I was like, I'm a whinge writer. I used to love whinging about it and being like, oh gosh, I've got this big thing to deliver. And what I found more recently, or what I found writing both of my books, is if I sit down at my desk at 7 a.m. or if I sit down at 1 p.m., I write the same amount. So I just stopped spending the first 8 hours of the day sitting there. So normally I have an app called Freedom that turns off the internet, turns everything off apart from Word. And then at the top of that page, I will write a list of things I will Google when I'm back online.
That's clever.
Because Google's designed to make you never leave.
You
these things are designed to keep you in it.
Yeah, you can fill those things in later. That's really smart, I think. Yeah, so let's get back on track with talking about your sort of daily routine.
Yes.
We got sidetracked.
So I get up, I normally go to, I'd like to exercise first thing. So before you're fully conscious that you're doing it, your day's beginning, you've already done your exercise. I walk here to Soho, and that takes about an hour and a half. I'd like a coffee, I like a bottle of water. I normally like a Barocca as well. And then I will...
That's a vitamin for anyone who's not familiar with Barocca.
Like a hypervitamin.
Fizzy vitamin drink.
Yeah, a branded fizzy vitamin drink. It's really for teenagers at festivals, but turns out it's powering my magazine articles. I think for a long time, when in my early days writing, I kept wanting to write like a writer and say things that felt, you know, how they should feel. And then I started just almost talking out loud on the page. And I think that connected me with more people quicker. People were just like, oh, yeah, you just write like a normal person. So just try and do that. And I will often talk out loud to myself and say, what does this really mean? You know, the Vogue column, I write about the heart of the internet, and I basically respond to what everyone's already talking about online. And what I try and do normally, I think I started in the pandemic, and for a lot of the pandemic, I was saying, this isn't going to last forever. It's going to be okay. And then now I feel like I'm saying, everyone just calm down online. This is what the real issue is with this issue. I think people are so quick at the moment, well, for a long time, to like give you a short hot take. And I quite like to just take a step back and try and do a bit more of bigger picture stuff about a subject.
Yeah, that's what I really liked about your Harry Styles column this week, actually, because the topic for anyone who missed it was that Harry Styles made this comment, that was it at the Grammys, about how this kind of thing doesn't usually happen to guys like me or something, and people were a bit outraged at what that really meant.
Yeah. What does that really mean?
But I think you were right that he was talking about class and the sort of people he grew up with, and I think it was nice to read something that was a bit nuanced about it.
Thanks. I think it's one of those things, it's not always my default to come out swinging for a really successful Grammy Award winning white guy and be like, leave Harry alone. But I was also just like, the way that British class structure works, it is not as clear cut as like black and white, which is much more how the American system works.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back in time a little bit. Did you write much as a child or a teenager?
Oh, good question. Did I write a lot as a kid? There was some talk of me being a writer. I remember doing a science project at school and inevitably writing a poem about like the periodic table. So I think I was always interested in writing. I think I worked at nowness.com, which is like an editorial video platform. And my editor-in-chief there was always encouraging me to write. And I just didn't really have the confidence to do it, So it's just come later that I felt like, oh, I could say something out loud.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you did a photography degree.
Yeah.
And then you've done a lot of visual work over the years. And it feels like it's really in the last sort of maybe 10 years that you've kind of emerged also as a writer. I don't know if I might have got that time frame wrong. So where did writing sort of arrive in your professional life? How did that shift happen?
When I left Nowness, I went freelance, and someone said to me, when you go freelance, you just say yes to everything for 2 years and then think about what your career is at the end of that. So I was like, yes, yes, yes to everything. And someone asked me to write a column for a magazine. So I was writing like nice little Instagram captions, so short stuff, as zeitgeisty as I could do it. And I had done a few written interviews when I was leaving Nowness. So I really enjoyed just saying my own words and not doing it for someone else. It was great. And I think that's what happens when you come out of a job, like a magazine job, that is it's all about interpersonal, institutional stuff. And I was just like, oh, I'm going alone. This is really exciting. And the more I wrote, the more I realized how many of the boxes it was ticking for me in terms of like what fulfills me at kind of like big life level.
Really interesting. Tell me more about that. Why?
Because I think my calling, I think what I like, I love chatting to other people. I love thinking about what's happening right at this moment and what it means for the future and the past. I think I like trying to be illuminating. And like that is a myriad of different things. Like, I feel like I love a party, I love going out dancing, and I like getting on the table, but I'm also want everyone to see it's possible to get on the table. It's not just about serving myself, I hope. So it's, and the writing does that too. It's like, I think this, but actually I'm trying to illuminate something for all of us that maybe we're not shining a light on quite like the way I can shine a light on it. And I love it.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about being a columnist, because you've had several columns. I know you write for American Vogue now. You were at British Vogue for a while. You did Sunday Times Style, maybe others as well. So tell me about that columnist life, and how do you approach that every week?
Something strange happened, because in those early days, I just think I was so precious and so kind of like argumentative about what I was writing, and so keen to like push what I thought was my voice, which was like incredibly sassy and glib and aloof, and I just felt like that was who I was going to be as a writer. And I think with confidence and time has come just like, oh, just say it like it happened, and people respond to it better. I enjoy writing it more. It just creates a different kind of proximity. But I think the column life is a good one. When I was at British Vogue, I had a really good time. I was writing about Friday nights and going, I was saying, this is what you can do on a Friday night. So it was kind of part review, part the week in review. That was really fun. Sunday Times Style came calling, and I just loved, I couldn't believe the reach. I mean, obviously they're huge, but I couldn't believe the kinds of people that were getting in touch to say that they liked what I'd written. Like my mate's mum in Surrey. And I was like, I don't know anyone in Surrey like who follows me on Instagram. Like it just completely changed the landscape for me.
If you write something for the Times, there's like, your sort of auntie's, you know, next door neighbor is reading it, and it is really weird. You sort of forget, I don't know, maybe it's a generational thing. You sort of forget that people are buying newspapers and
really poring over their Sunday supplements.
Yeah,
it was great.
It was lovely.
So I loved that. And then American Vogue, I basically in press for the first book, I did an interview with them called A Zoom of One's Own, and it was like me and an editor and two interns chatting about being stuck at home in the pandemic. And then I was like, I want to write a column for them. So I pitched to the editor, hey, I think I should write a column. And then I DM'd the two interns, hi, I've just pitched to your editor, I think I should write. I was like, it's so funny, I've never been a careerist. I couldn't tell you where I'm going to be in 5, 10, 15 years, but once I have an idea in my head of what I want, I'm like, that's what I want. So I'm just going to try and get it. So I was quite dogged. She replied saying, we don't really need a columnist. And I was like, look, you have loads of people reporting the news. Like, it's really easy to say, Harry Styles said this thing at the Met Gala, at the Grammys. What I want to do is just wait a couple of days and say, oh, let's reflect on that. And she was like, let's just try it. So we went into it, and it's been
good work.
A couple of years. So I pitch on a Tuesday night, and then I write on a Wednesday. And it's normally not a lot of... Their edits are always really good, but they're not like...
It's not heavy rewriting and all that stuff.
The Sunday supplements are rigorous. I've never known anything quite like it. I was like, wow, this is 3 days of my life. Whereas the Americans that I work for are so on it, and they just are like, just tie it up. Make it really just little tweaks.
Yeah. So when you pitch ideas to them, are you sending them a few ideas, or is it...
No, I send them one. I say, this week is the title. And then I say, what about this?
And they normally just say, yeah.
Yeah. Or they say, someone's just written about this. Do you have a different point of view? And I'm like, nope, that was my point of view on Sam Smith's video. So let's move on. but most of the time, because I pitch the column And I think in those early days, I was sort of talking about J.K. Rowling potentially being transphobic. Let's put that caveat in there. So I was talking about that stuff. And then as we went through like kind of like Black Lives Matter, and we were moving into much more of a like, not a woke state, but I was much more like, the first piece that really kind of turned things for me was the day after Trump got elected. And I was just like, I hope you're okay. You just need to rest today because you've been up all night watching the election, and the fight is really far from over. And I've never written anything that was so just like giving something to someone else. It was always like, here's my little line on Trump being orange. So it just felt like, it felt so good to just to be like, just to see where people are at and talk to them where they're at.
Yeah.
Rather than bring them to me in my column.
Yeah. So did writing because both of your books have been sort of collections of essays, does that feel quite similar to doing a column, or does it feel like quite a different experience?
I think for me, it's going to sound, it sounds so broad, but like it, for me, it's about telling the truth. And I think the more honest I could be about the men in my life, the more it's like fed me as like a creative process. And I think whenever I'm writing something that feels like how to have the perfect party, and it's just pulling ideas from my head, and that's a bit more ambient, it's less like thrilling for me to do that. It's less exposing, it's less vulnerable, and therefore it's nice, but it's not like,
doesn't mean anything.
I've done it. Yeah. I've done this thing. And I think the first book of essays for me, it's a bit like Lily Allen's Smile. No one really likes their first big hit, but even though it's good, and it was good at the time, and I still love parts of it, it felt for me much more a lot of room songs, right? We're just doing it. I'm giving you 10 great lines about the Spice Girls, which everyone wants to hear. But this Men for me was much more about, here's something, here are some things that have happened to me. Here are some relationships that I think are really interesting, and not say, dads are, what are they like?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, this is my relationship with my dad. This is my relationship with my stepdad. This is me when I was 16 and what I thought being a man was at 16 and 30 and what I think it will be in the future.
Yeah, to me, this the second book feels quite different to the first book. And I want to come back to this in a minute to talk a bit about that slight shift in tone, maybe. Just on a practical note,
yep.
I know you've said before that you use a dictation app.
Yes.
Do you still do that?
Less so. So when I first started, I was really blocked and I was like, I cannot write a book. I can't write the first word of this book. I remember being the same about my dissertation, which was 3,000 words, which now seems like click of the fingers. I just remember talking to my therapist and being and she was like, what can you do? And I was like, I'm just gonna have to talk out loud into something. And I found that talking about a subject for the first 4 minutes, you get that kind of pitter patter, and then beyond that you start to dig deeper into what ice cream really means. So that really helped me get out in. And then you sit down and you've got 2,000 words of writing on a page, and most of it's gibberish, but it's not a blank page.
Yeah.
Which to me was more daunting than anything else.
But as time has gone on, you've felt less need for that part of the process.
I think I'm a compulsive note taker. So I make lots of notes of like one-liners, things I think are interesting, turns of phrase that like tinkle on the piano of my mind. And so I have all these notes. And what I was doing with the first book was like looking at notes and trying to build witty prose around a subject from these notes. And now the notes are kind of like secondary. It's like, this is what happened.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell it to you the best way that I know how.
Yeah. I remember somebody saying to me years ago, which I found really helpful, in feature writing, think about how you would think about, like, say I go and interview somebody and then I have to write it up in 2,000 words or whatever. Think about, like, what did you tell your boyfriend about that interview afterwards?
Yeah.
Like, what was the first thing you told them? And like, start with the basically the most interesting thing and tell it that. And I found that really changed the way I wrote and was really helpful.
Yeah, that is really helpful. And I'm just thinking about an interview that I submitted that maybe was not my best work.
We've all got them.
It's been keeping me awake for like 3 weeks. And I'm like, where are the notes?
Oh.
Because I'm ready to rewrite it. I'm just waiting to hear that.
I hate that whole process of waiting for an editor to get back to you. And I've been an editor and kept people waiting, even though, like, not on purpose, but it just happens because you're busy. But when you're at home and you're waiting for somebody to tell you whether they liked your piece or not, it's like, it's sickening. It makes me feel so anxious, especially if you sort of feel like maybe they're not going to be that pleased with it.
Yeah. I was rusty, right? So I've come back from Christmas. When I'm writing it every day, sitting down to write it's like a muscle that's just been trained again. And I was rusty going into it. And then I just have this sense of like, what's really difficult for someone like me who loves to talk about themselves is to have to take yourself out of the situation in order to convey it. And that's essentially for me, I just rely on like, here's an anecdote I have from another time that's like this, that will keep us all, like, that makes sense. And you can't do that with a Hollywood actor. You just have to be like, she looked amazing in jeans and a t-shirt and not a scrap of makeup. It's like, that's, and then it's like, I don't want to write cliches, but she did.
Yeah. I'm sure it was really good.
Thanks.
I'm sure no news is good news. Let's talk about Instagram for a minute.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't make your heart sink when people bring up Instagram.
Not at all.
You've got 168,000 followers.
I have.
Pretty good. You're very popular on there. People find you hilarious. Mm. I find you hilarious. I would say that your sort of magic thing there is putting together exactly the right sort of unexpected image with an unexpected witty one-line caption. I was wondering, when social media arrived, like back in the noughties or whatever, did you have a sense that this was going to be a great platform for your sense of humour?
No.
Really?
Let me think.
I was wondering if you were brilliant on Facebook before you were, you know.
Oh, I was good on, I think the thing is with me is that I've always had good chat and I've always cared about current things. And I think, like I said about coming to writing later, I've been like this in a room of six people in an office for like 20 years, but they're the only audience was six people. So for me, it's exciting that more than six people can hear me doing my, like,
your joke that you're really banter, pleased with. Yeah.
My patter. My Beyonce patter. Well, it's the same as most things. I was doing a lot of Instagram that was like really nice pictures, being like, oh, I love this David Sim image, la la la. And then I moved into just, I wanted to make stuff that was timely and timeless. And I think that was where the internet was in a kind of, in a way, in that like 2012 to 15. And I think people just stopped caring about timeless. They just want something really current and really on the nose, and they won't care about it tomorrow. And I actually shifted with that, and I was like, this is what's really funny to me right now today, and then I move on.
Yeah.
I've felt that shift from being like, I want to make something, I want to have a feed you can scroll back on and it still has meaning, to like,
nobody does that. No, so who cares? No,
it's just, yeah, and it's obviously becomes like a terror of like, yesterday's chip paper is a real tough one to like live through in real time, because I'm fine with it until I have a book to bring out and I'm like, this can't be yesterday's chip paper. Please don't do this to me. Not this one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but I feel like that about other stuff all the time.
Books are different though. I had a look back. I did actually have a look back through your Instagram grid preparing for this, and some of them are so, so funny. And I think a couple of my favourites were, one of them was Heidi Klum in her worm costume.
Yeah.
I've actually forgotten now what your caption
me
was.
Me too.
It was something like, oh, me when my camera's off on Zoom or something. That was really funny. And there was another one. Still making you laugh.
Yeah.
And the other one that I really liked was the photo of you and Pharrell, which you captioned something like, maybe you can remember it word for word.
It's like, the man that never ages
finally met Pharrell.
I mean, he is something else. I've never seen anyone look so young.
I mean, he's like a wizard or something.
Yeah.
Shirley or...
Yeah, well, I mean, I was doing work for his skincare brand, so I'm assuming that is the magic.
Yeah. I read an interview with you where the journalist said that on Instagram you speak in what could be termed gay internet, which I guess by that he meant that there's a sort of pop culture / fashion focus, and it's a very irreverent tone. But you write in Men, your second book, in a book in which I do perceive a bit of a shift in tone, that you don't want to be thought of as an infinite jester, and there are definitely, you know, some very good, more serious essays in that book. I really particularly like the one about your dad. Do you feel like that's been an important part of your kind of development over the last few years as a writer? That
the shift?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I didn't have the confidence to be properly vulnerable. I had the confidence to like give you dinner party chat and do that exceptionally well, or as well as I could. I mean, enjoy it exceptional amounts. And I think the brutality of things that have happened to me, I just was like, I can't shy away from the difficult stuff. Basically, I wrote a piece for The Observer for my first book about my dad, about when I was seven and he said I wasn't black enough when I went to visit him, and how that has had such a big impact on like how I feel about my race, how I feel about my class, how I feel about my roots, how I feel about the main guy in my life saying basically you're not living up to my expectations. And I think the response to that was so huge, and I was like, wait, but I just wrote what happened with this guy. And then I was like, wait, there's other men. Then I pitched the book. So, and it was like 3 months after the first one came out, and about 9 months after that I started it, and it literally just poured out of me, because I, like everyone else, I'd been sitting at home stuck in my head for so long. I wrote 40,000 words in a month, which is like, I don't think I could ever do that again. And quality, not just like, I remember this guy, and how did that feel? How did it feel in the moment, and how do I feel about it now? And just trying to evoke that feeling. And I think you're right, where the first book is kind of more internet-y and like strings of really nice DNA strings of tweets.
Yeah. It's very dense on jokes, the first, yeah, and sentence.
And I did that foolish thing. I read the Amazon reviews and people were is a headache. And I was like, they're right.
Oh, no.
But this one isn't. I heard what they were saying and I was like, wait, I don't need to hide behind one-liners in order to tell a good story. And then that's just where it went. And yeah, it's just, it's much more serious, and it still has a lot of jokes in it and a lot of fun guys. And I think I will come back to like not kind of filleting my emotions quite so brutally in book three. But, and also, I think I enjoy telling a story. So I think it's like, let's tell some stories I enjoy next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you feel you're striving for as a writer?
That moment when I'm writing and I'm like, this is so good.
I think we're all striving
right?
for that. Yeah.
When it feels like it's like coming through you onto the page, it's coming from somewhere else and you're like, ha ha ha, this is it. And I think to be able to, for other people to feel like that when they're reading it, is the dream. But it doesn't feel labored. It just feels like, oh, I just went for it. And this is just like, oh.
Is there anything you find particularly challenging as a writer?
I can't really spell, but that's...
Really?
No. Really, no. My pronunciation's awful too, but again, not that much of a problem. I mean, only a problem when you have to spend 4 days reading your memoir in a box for the audiobook. That's when your pronunciation becomes a major problem. Especially when you, like, put in French words in your book sometimes. Very foolish.
Well, now you know that. You just put less French words in your next
yeah.
one.
Yeah. I think for me, the time it takes to get from a book to be in your head and then in front of other people, it's so long. That gamble, that ball, you throw it so high in the air, and it takes so long before you even know if you can catch it. Like, it's just gone for ages. I find that really hard, especially when you write a tweet and you know if people like it in 30 seconds. Just like, I find that's the thrillingness of it. Is this ball good enough to throw in the air and come back down in 18 months? Like, that's the fun of a book.
I love that. That's a really good analogy. Do you remember any writing advice or feedback that you've had over the years that you think really improved your work?
I think for me, in book writing, you get a lot less line edits. And in the way that in magazine writing, you get quite a lot. And sometimes I can hear my magazine editors when I'm writing my books.
And what are they saying?
What? Get to the point. Yeah, get to the point. What's this? What am I trying to say? I will say that out loud to myself all the time. And sometimes when you're, you don't really have an opinion, you can just report what's happened and then put an opinion at the end. And sometimes that's really nice, but you have to be like, the opinion at the end has to really give this the tightest knot. And in that column I wrote this week, I was like, I don't know how to conclude this, because privilege isn't one thing or something else. It's just a mashed potato of different things that have happened to you, that you're born into, that you've earned because you were born into it, that you've inherited, that have come to you by chance and all that stuff. So sometimes the conclusion is, I don't know where we go from here.
Yeah. When I went in-house at the Times for a year, and before that I'd done loads of writing, mostly for online, for like The Cut and The Pool, which is sadly dead. And it wasn't until I went to the Times that my editor, who had like zero patience for bad copy, was just like, you need to get to the point pretty much immediately. Like, I need to know in the first paragraph what the point of this article is.
Yeah.
You can't spend three paragraphs doing like a lovely whimsical lead-in.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really, really eye-opening, actually. I think newspaper writing, I think, does sort of make you crack on with things a bit more rigorously.
Yeah, I always feel like it's a blind spot that when I was being asked to write when I was, you know, 21, I just didn't do it. So I've never been that person, that junior writer in an office that's like cracking out profiles about gallery shows. It's never happened to me. So I feel privileged and like lacking because of that. It's both of those things for me.
What are you, just thinking specifically about your writing life, what do you feel the most proud of?
Second book, I love. Because it's such a testament to like not hiding in any way. And that's just like, let's just show it. I'm really proud of that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm proud of. I mean, having like two books out just seems like something that, you know, Raven Smith the Younger just didn't think was possible. Even when I had the first deal, I didn't think it was possible to actually write a book. And all I could think was, how do people actually do this? How can there be so many books in the British Library? This is so hard.
I know.
Why doesn't everyone just give up?
I think that all the time, all the time. Yeah. But you did, you threw the ball in the air and you caught it twice.
True.
Thank you so much to Raven Smith for being such a funny and thoughtful guest. His second book, Men, has just come out in paperback. Check the episode notes for a link to buy it from the In Writing bookshop. You can also find books by other guests of the podcast, plus some of my favourite books at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing. If you'd like to receive my newsletter, it's at inwriting.substack.com, which is in the notes. You can also join me there for live writing hours on Google Meet. We're doing one this Sunday, the 26th of February, as it happens. The Substack is also a good forum to speak to other people who are interested in writing and to discuss the podcast. A reminder before we go that if you want to take your writing to the next level, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. That's all for now, but I'll be back next week with a novelist. Thanks for listening.